Today is Friday, the 20th of December, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the Democrats held their last debate of 2019 last evening, and we take a look at who stood out and who may have a hard road ahead in the primaries.
I'm running because I've been around. On my experience. With experience, hopefully comes judgment and a little bit of wisdom.
Plus, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he wants to deliver a Brexit vote by Christmas. And protests continue in India over a constitutional citizenship bill. Those stories and more are all coming up next. Seven leading U.S. Democratic presidential candidates squared off in a spirited debate late Thursday with quick attacks on the newly impeached U.S. President Donald Trump. Candidate Elizabeth Warren called the impeachment a constitutional moment in the debate hosted by PBS NewsHour and Politico.
But the way I see this is we've now seen the impact of corruption, and that's what's clearly on the stage in 2020. Is how we are going to run against the most corrupt president in living history.
All of the challengers seeking the Democratic nomination to take on Trump in next year's national election said they supported the House of Representatives' adoption 24 hours before of two articles of impeachment accusing Mr. Trump of abusing the power of the presidency and obstruction of Congress. But that wasn't the only topic that was discussed on stage. Senator Bernie Sanders discussed wealth and power.
The issue is where power resides in America. And it's not white or black or male or female. We are living in a nation increasingly becoming an oligarchy, where you have a handful of billionaires who spend hundreds of millions of dollars buying elections and politicians.
Former Vice President Joe Biden also brought up humanitarian issues.
A million Uyghurs, as you pointed out, Muslims, are in concentration camps. That's what they are right now. They're being abused. They're in concentration camps. And what we started in our administration that Trump stopped, we should be moving 60% of our sea power to that area of the world to let, in fact, the Chinese understand that they're not going to go any further. We are going to be there to protect other folks.
Now joining us in the studio to break down last night's debate in full is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, welcome to the program today.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, Jim. So you watched the debate. Who did well last night?
Well, you'd have to say that the current frontrunner, Joe Biden, had one of his stronger performances, so that is likely to keep him at the top of the polls. It was a good night for him. I think Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar had some strong moments. I think Bernie Sanders had some strong moments. You know, Bernie had that heart issue a while back, had kind of slipped in the polls. He's actually kind of rebounded a bit. And in many surveys now, he's like the number two candidate. And that means people like Elizabeth Warren have struggled. And what was interesting about the Thursday debate was that Warren and Klobuchar decided to go after Pete Buttigieg.
So why is that?
Why is that is because look at the calendar. The votes start February 3rd in Iowa. We're getting close. They need to make a move. And Iowa, of course, is that critical early state, holds the Iowa caucuses that will kick off the campaign season in early February. And Buttigieg has risen to the top of the polls, not by much, but he's up at the top. So Klobuchar and Warren now see an opportunity to go after him and try to improve their standing. There's an old saying, there are three tickets out of Iowa and two out of New Hampshire, which is the next state to vote. They're all vying for that right now. Biden is not in the very top group in Iowa, but he doesn't necessarily have to be. But some of these other lesser-known candidates who are further down in the polls, they have to do well in Iowa.
Now speaking of candidates who are down lower in the polls, we have a current field of Democratic candidates of about 15. Seven made the debate qualifications. Who didn't do as well on Thursday night's debate?
Well, I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren has had sort of a slowing of momentum in recent weeks. She's actually dropped down in the polls, not only nationally, but in some of the earlier states. So she needs to rebound, and I think was looking for that Thursday debate to do that. One interesting thing is, in any kind of debate, where there's an attack going on. Often the two people, you know, involved in the attack don't always fare very well. And what I noticed in that debate last night was that Joe Biden was off to the side. He wasn't a part of that. And he actually could benefit from that because Buttigieg had some strong responses, but also at times it may be perceived by some voters as a little on the angry side. And again, a strong response is fine, but sometimes you don't know how it's going to play with the voters.
So we only have about 40 seconds left now. Between now and that Iowa caucus, what can we expect from the candidates?
There'll be another debate, I think, in mid-January in Iowa. That'll be an important moment. And it's from now on, it's a furious sprint to actually try to win over town by town voters in the state of Iowa to get that campaign going.
Jim Malone is VOA's national correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us on this Friday.
You bet.
British lawmakers gave preliminary approval Friday to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit bill, clearing the way for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union next month. Speaking in the House of Commons, Johnson said the bill he put forward rejects any future delays.
It ensures that we depart from the EU on the 31st of January, and at that point Brexit will be done. It will be over. The sorry story of the last 3.5 years will be at an end, and we will be able to move forward, Mr. Speaker, together. The bill ensures that the implementation period must end on the 31st of December next year with no possibility of an extension.
Now joining us on the phone for more is reporter Henry Ridgewell in London. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Steve, on what appears to be finally a decisive day on Brexit.
Exactly. So what went down today in the House of Commons?
Boris Johnson won that vote, as you've heard, by 124 votes. And if we rewind a week to the general election, he had a majority of 80 in that election. So it's clear that a lot of the opposition, even on the opposition benches to his Brexit deal, has crumbled. It looks like certainly that Britain is on the path to leaving the European Union on the 31st of January. This particular piece of legislation has passed what we call the second reading in the House of Commons. It now goes over to the upper chamber, the House of Lords, where it could face amendments. And there are 3 days set aside in January to try to finish the process off, the third reading, before the bill would become law. And then, under agreement from London with that bill passed and from Brussels, Britain would leave the European Union on January the 31st.
And then what does the end of the year 2020 signal for Britain and the United Kingdom after the 31st?
Well, that's a key question because one amendment that was made to this Brexit bill that hadn't been in it before was one that prevents the government or Parliament from extending that transition period. At the moment, there is a sort of status quo transition where after the 31st of January, relations between Britain and the European Union stay exactly the same until the end of December 2020, by which time Boris Johnson promises he will have a trade deal ready to go and signed with the European Union. Now, no international trade deal has been agreed in that short length of time. If you look at the deal that the European Union has struck with Canada or with Japan in recent years, it's taken several years just to negotiate and then several years to ratify in the Parliament. At the moment, any trade deal needs to be ratified in every single one of the other 27 member state parliaments before it becomes law. So it's a hugely ambitious timetable from Boris Johnson. You've seen reaction in the markets in the last couple of days. The pound has erased all of its gains that it made with his election win over fears that a no-deal Brexit is back on the table at the end of 2020, because now it will effectively be law that he can't extend that transition period. And so we're facing a possible other cliff edge, and that's going to be the big argument of 2020.
We have 1 minute left. There's other news coming out of Britain today with a former diplomat's wife being charged in a crime that she left the country for, and Prince Philip in the hospital. What can you give us really quickly as an update?
Sure. As you say, lots of news from Britain today. Firstly, that diplomat's wife, Anne Sakoulas, was involved in a car accident in August. A 19-year-old man died, Harry Dunn. She initially was interviewed by police and then went back to the United States claiming diplomatic immunity. The family have been pushing for prosecution, and today Britain's Crown Prosecution Service say it will charge Anne Sakoulas with the murder, with the killing of Harry Dunn. Anne Sakoulas's lawyers say that they think that is a very unsuitable way to be using an extradition warrant under diplomatic immunity, so there looks to be a diplomatic situation developing there. The second story you mentioned there, Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, just days before Christmas has been taken to hospital in London. Buckingham Palace insists this is just a precautionary measure. He is in his 90s now, of course. He was involved in a car accident in January. They say this is nothing serious, but clearly the royal family will be hoping desperately that he will be able to rejoin them for the Christmas Day festivities in a few days' time.
Henry Ridgewell's in London. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Steve.
The United States says it has new evidence and analysis of weapons debris recovered from an attack on Saudi oil fields on September 14th that indicates the strike likely came from the north, reinforcing its earlier assessment that Iran was behind the offensive. Reuters' Eimear McCarthy has those details.
The United States is reinforcing its assessment that Iran was behind an offensive on Saudi oil facilities in September. New evidence and an analysis of weapons debris from the states indicate that the strike likely came from the north. In an interim report of its investigation, seen by Reuters ahead of a presentation on Thursday to the United Nations Security Council, Washington assessed that before hitting its targets, one of the drones traversed a location approximately 124 miles to the northwest of the attack site. However, the report noted that the weapons analysis did not definitely reveal the origin of the strike that initially knocked out half of Saudi Arabia's oil production. The United States, European powers and Saudi Arabia blamed the attack on Iran. Yemen's Houthi group claimed responsibility for the attacks, and Iran, which supports the Houthis, denied any involvement. Yemen is south of Saudi Arabia.
That was Reuters reporter Eimear McCarthy, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers led by Binghamton University in Upper New York State is reporting that they have discovered the remains of the oldest forest in Earth's history. The scientists say their discovery provides evidence that the transition from ancient to modern forests began earlier than thought. What the research team found while going through ancient soil near Cairo, New York, were the remnants of an extensive root system of 385 million-year-old trees. This discovery is said to predate the fossil forest at nearby Gilboa, New York, which formerly held the title of world's oldest forest. The researchers say they found three different tree species within the ancient widespread root system. While seed-bearing plants didn't emerge until some 10 million years later, the trees forming the ancient root system had qualities similar to modern seed plants. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Authorities shut down the internet in parts of India Friday and imposed a curfew, and two people died in protest. For the latest update, I spoke with Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi. Anjana, what can you tell us about this internet shutdown in parts of northern India and the deaths during the protests?
Well, you know, the internet shutdown is part of government efforts to keep a lid on the protests. They want to prevent people from organizing themselves and from gathering and communicating with each other. So as a part of this effort, the police has also banned public gatherings in several places and shut down the internet, as you said. In particular, I think the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, which is emerging as a flashpoint for these protests, there the internet shutdown is fairly wide. We also had the internet shut down in the capital, New Delhi, yesterday for some time in a few districts, and that has happened also today in just one place where the protests are taking place.
What about the deaths that were reported in the news?
Yes, we have reports of 7 people having died. Now, I have to say that 5 of this was last week when the protests were taking place. This was in the northeastern state of Assam. Yesterday, 2 people were killed in a southern city when protesters clashed with police, and the police opened fire. As a result, we had 2 deaths there and 1 in another northern Indian city.
These protests have been going on for about a week now after the introduction of the citizenship bill. We've been talking about protests taking place in the northern parts of India, in the southern parts of India. Can you give our listeners an idea of how widespread these protests are across the nation?
These protests are pretty widespread, right from the northeastern state of Assam, eastern areas, and going down to towns and cities, which are very prominent. Of course, the capital, New Delhi, the IT hub of Bengaluru, where we saw widespread protests yesterday, the financial hub of Mumbai, where also we saw a large protest yesterday. So they are pretty much pan-India protests.
The government has said it is not looking at withdrawing this bill, but as the protests continue, as the internet blackouts are put in place, what is the government's plan to try and quell the dissent that continues to rise?
So far, we have not had any clear statement from the government. The few statements that have come out when they've spoken to the media is just to say that they stand behind the law, they don't see anything wrong with the law, and they're not going to revoke it. And also, but what they have said is that no Indian citizen has reason to be concerned, their nationality will not be taken away. They are blaming opposition parties for spreading rumors. But what has people concerned is just not the law in itself. What has them concerned is plans by the government to roll out what is known in India as the National Register of Citizenship. In this, every person would be asked to prove that they or their ancestors lived in India. This is something very difficult for poor people to do. In India, record keeping for poor people is extremely poor. They don't have birth certificates, etc., etc. So the real concern is also with these government plans to roll out a nationwide National Register of Citizens.
Anjana, what would be the implications of not being able to prove your ancestry?
Nobody really knows. There is just talk. There is talk of people would be moved to detention centers. They cannot be taken to another country. It's all up in the air, Steve. Nobody knows that. It's already taken place in one state, in Assam, where nearly 2 million people were found not eligible for Indian citizenship. They have an appeals process to go through. But I think the nationwide concern is that this is going to be very, very hard, especially on poor people. The whole process is going to be very hard. So far, the government has not retracted from plans to implement this. Their plans, let me stress, so far. There's been nothing firm that they're going to actually do it, but they have said in Parliament, we have plans to do this.
And that was Anjana Pasricha speaking to me from New Delhi. The World Health Organization says insecurity and lack of access in conflict-ridden parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo remain major threats to ending the Ebola outbreak there. Lisa Schlein reports the latest says the number of confirmed cases are at more than 3,300, including over 2,200 deaths.
Health officials are concerned progress made against the Ebola outbreak in the North Kivu and Ituri provinces could come undone because of ongoing fighting among dozens of armed groups. The World Health Organization says the deadly virus has been cleared from 25 of the region's health zones. It says an average of 4 to 10 new cases a week have been recorded in 4 zones in recent weeks. However, the executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Mike O'Ryan, says there's been a big increase recently in the number of cases in North Kivu's Mabalako zone.
And last week, 4th to 10th of December, the number of cases jumped to 27 in a single week. So that's nearly a threefold increase, more than a threefold increase in 1 week, which is quite remarkable.
Ryan tells VOA the new cases are linked to a single chain of transmission stemming from one infected individual.
This case was a case most likely of a relapsed infection or someone who relapsed from having been previously recovered. And this has occurred in an area that's quite insecure and been very difficult to operate in. And it's most worrying because one of the contacts from that transmission chain ended up moving to Butembo and died in Butembo.
Ryan recalls that 6 months ago, Ebola was raging in Butembo, which is also in North Kivu. He says there is real concern that continued transmission of the virus in Mabalako could potentially reinfect Butembo, which would be a major setback to Ebola containment efforts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The legal thriller Dark Waters follows corporate defense attorney Rob Billett as he investigates the causes of widespread illnesses and the death of cattle and people in a farm community in West Virginia. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more on this movie based on a true story.
How many did you lose?
190.
190 cows.
You tell me nothing's wrong here.
After some hesitation, Cincinnati corporate attorney Rob Billott, played by Mark Ruffalo, agrees to investigate farmer Wilbur Tennant's claims that DuPont's chemical waste into a creek next to his land is killing his cattle. Billott, who was originally hired by his law firm to defend corporations like DuPont, turns against the corporate giant.
What is this? PFOA. What's that stand for?
Jesus, you're on a goddamn fishing expedition.
Bill, I need to insist on broadening discovery.
Sue me!
I'm already suing you.
Billott established that PFOAS, or man-made chemicals, caused elevated risks of cancer, kidney disease, thyroid conditions, and autoimmune disorders. He gathered evidence through depositions from plant employees, public records, and an epidemiological study in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Has anyone even read the evidence this man has collected? The willful negligence, the corruption? Read it. We should want to nail DuPont. All of us should. American business is better than this, gentlemen.
Tim Robbins plays Tom Terp, chairman and managing partner of Billott's legal team, Taft.
Corporate culture tends to protect itself. And Tom was someone that dared to go against that.
A 2016 article by the New York Times called Billott the lawyer who became DuPont's worst nightmare. His research brought worldwide awareness into the dangers of chemicals like PFOAS. They had known for a long time that this stuff was bad, says Billott.
In 2017, we were able to enter into a settlement with DuPont for about 3,500 people who had claims at that point in time. There are additional people that are still finding out that they've been exposed and that they have cancer. There are additional cases that are popping up all over the country. We shouldn't all be being used as guinea pigs.
Mark Ruffalo interprets Billott and produced the film Dark Waters. He is also an environmental activist advocating for the regulation of forever chemicals, as PFOAS and PFAS have been nicknamed.
I think 3M and DuPont are going to have to, they're going to have to take some responsibility for what they did. They knowingly brought this product onto the market, knowing that it caused cancers, birth defects, endocrine diseases, and they went ahead anyway.
Almost heaven, West Virginia.
Dark Waters is not the first film to focus on waters polluted by PFAS.
Governor Snyder, I got some Flint water for you.
In his documentary Fahrenheit 11/9, filmmaker Michael Moore casts a light on policies he says led to contaminated waters in communities such as Flint, Michigan.
I feel like storytelling is a way to transcend the politics and get people to be reconsider an issue based on human-to-human contact.
Meanwhile, the fight of Rob Billott against DuPont continues. While DuPont has not assumed responsibility for knowingly using hazardous chemicals, it has announced that it is eliminating the use of PFAS, chemicals which experts say are persistent in the environment and in the human body. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today and this week. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day and a super weekend.